This is Pup Crime. I'm your host, Wesley Fox, editor and prefect of PrescientSciFi.com. Today, I'm joined by Rhett C. Bruno to talk about his new novel, The Circuit, Progeny of Vale. It is the second installment in the Circuit series, and it is a great book. So first off, Rhett, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So first, I guess maybe we should lay down a little bit of the premise. We did a show on the first book a while back, but I don't know. Can you maybe just get us into the premise of The Circuit? You know, where is this taking place, and like, who are the players?
Sure. So the premise, The Circuit, it takes place in a future version of Earth, about 500 years in the future. We discover an element under the Earth's mantle that allows us to generate artificial gravity, and the people that live on Earth then mine it so much that the planet begins to fall apart. So The Circuit is the intersolar civilization they develop outside of Earth while after Earth completely falls, using this element, which is called graviton. So the story follows a group of characters in that future as they're dealing with living there, and this group called the Tribune has risen to power with a belief that if they redeem themselves, the Earth will heal and humans will be able to return. But they're kind of a tyrannical leadership, and our characters, which there's four main characters, either serve them, are their enemy, or are sort of playing with them, and it all sprouts from one of their former leaders, Cassius Vale, who wants revenge against the Tribune and will do anything to get it.
Okay, so the Tribune, as I remember, there, and this is, this book is character driven, in my opinion. I mean, the world building I wanted to do first, because in science fiction, it's kind of what we're almost required to do as a step one.
Yeah.
But, so the Tribune, the impression I got, they're kind of like a theocracy. They've built this kind of system around a belief in the New Earth spirit. Is that kind of the concept?
They just call it the spirit of the Earth. But yeah, they believe that the Earth has its own living spirit, which similar to how some religions are today. And that if we abide by their rules and honor that spirit, the Earth will heal from all the destruction that's happened to it, and humans will be able to return.
Okay, and they have this kind of group of, they kind of reminded me a little bit of like this really specialized special operations group called Executors, where the first book gets its name, Executor Rising, and they are. So they're basically like super soldiers, but they also have a bio implant that kind of allows the Tribune to monitor them, see through their eyes, and kind of control their thoughts. So, is that about right?
So yeah, so it's not something that enhances strength. They're just extremely well-trained soldiers, but it takes away all their pain and emotions, and also allows the Tribune to see what they're seeing through their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't know about that part. They just know how the implant dulls all their pain and really is what allows them to become these super soldiers, because they fear nothing and they feel nothing. They just will do whatever it takes to honor the Tribune.
Okay, so they kind of control, and the Circuit is basically, it's called the Circuit because it's like the settlements or the planets or the asteroids that are all inhabited post-Earth are roughly a ring, like around the solar system, correct? Kind of along the asteroid belt, Mars.
Yes.
The moons of Jupiter, the moons of, you know, some of the major dwarf planets.
Yeah, and then they're all threaded together by these massive solar arc delivery ships, which kind of are a neutral party that brings materials and resources around between all the different settlements. So that's the group that distributes the graviton from Earth and water and food.
And Cirrus, I guess this is part, like, so there's also an insurgency or a group that fought a war with the Tribune and lost, and they're centered around the dwarf planet of Cirrus. And
yes.
They call themselves the Clans. They're kind of like organized criminal, or almost organized crime, but also kind of factions, political factions as well. And they lost the war, and they're kind of, I couldn't get this right. Is Cirrus still independent, or is it under Tribune control?
They're independent, but it's sort of like Japan after World War II.
Okay.
They're independent, but they are pretty much watched at all times.
Or Vichy France or something like that. Yeah. Okay. And then there's a new group in this book, which I thought was kind of cool, and I'm hoping you get into it maybe in the next book, is I think they're called the Vergents.
Yes.
And they are, now who are they? They're also kind of an outsider group, but who are they?
So the Vergents are the people that live so far out in the solar system that they really haven't become a part of either of these major parties, which is the people that come from Ceres, and then right now the Tribune has taken over everything else. So they're the people that are way further out, the only ones who really still rely on the ships of the circuit to keep surviving.
All right. Okay. Because they also have some unique physical characteristics and kind of a different kind of view on things. I thought it was kind of interesting when they're featured in some of the scenes. So I kind of wanted to go over the political factions first and kind of the layout first. Kind of one, because it's science fiction, and sometimes when, you know, it's space opera or those kind of things, we kind of need to do that first. But also kind of just to emphasize, like, the one thing I kind of liked about this book in comparison to other space operas is it kind of stays in the gray areas, kind of like the way Game of Thrones is, in the sense that you don't really know, there's no real clear good guys wearing white or wearing beige, and the bad guys don't really wear black, and, you know, or, well, maybe in some of them you kind of get the impression they're evil, but yeah, there doesn't seem to be a clarity on who's good, who's evil, like who, like what is. So I kind of like that kind of that all the characters kind of are in this gray area with a few exceptions. And the way I wanted to lay it out was, you know, when we first go over this, you get the idea that the Tribune is like this evil, oppressive theocracy, and in a lot of respects they are. But at the same time, you know, the clans of Cirrus, the Vergents, they're not exactly angels, and they're not exactly freedom fighters. And Cassius Vale is, I think, the way it kind of sums it up. He's, you know, the titular character. He's one of the four points of view that you mentioned, the four main characters. And to me, he came off, and he has left the Tribune, and he's leading this revenge plot against them. And he kind of struck me as a little bit, you know, he's technically the guy going up against the oppressive, you know, Imperial Tribune. And yet he comes off as kind of a sociopath and ruthless, and he's a soldier and all those things. And I kind of wonder, like, when you decided to go that direction with, like, one of the key characters, like, did you base him on anyone, or did you base him on kind of an archetype or something? Because he's very unusual that he's driving the ultimate plot, but he's not, you know, there's a lot of things about him not to like.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's funny because I just wrote a short article to hopefully go somewhere about him, where I sort of decide that, in my opinion, he serves the role of an anti-villain. So yeah, just kind of taking the idea of the anti-hero and sort of shifting it on his head, where he comes off as the hero and at all times, but really it's only because you're in his point of view. And if you were outside of it with any of the characters and you were never in his point of view, you would really see that throughout the whole story, he's the antagonist. And he always was in developing the story. And I know some people reading the first one that they didn't really see that, and they expected the Tribune were the antagonists and thought they were underdeveloped. Because he really serves as that character. He's the villain, and it's because you're in his head that you ever really think he's the hero. So I wouldn't say he's based on anyone specific. I just probably took from villains here and there, but I wanted him to be this charismatic villain that you see all the time when he's in front of people. But when he gets alone, you see how broken and really twisted he's become. So back to the point of everyone being gray, there is no good or evil character in this book. It really is up to the reader to decide. Even the Tribune, as evil as they might seem, they're keeping order. They're keeping people alive in what's really a Wild West sort of setting. And Cassius is the only one to come in and really shake it up, because he doesn't care about consequences. He really almost is a sociopath. He doesn't feel regret or anything except for towards the son he lost, which is what drives him towards everything he does.
Yeah, that's kind of that's the event that puts this whole thing in motion, is his son's murder, as if I got that right. He was murdered by the Tribune, and Cassius discovered it, that it was supposed to make, they were supposed to make it look like an accident, but I guess he figured it out, and he has now been putting together this plot to overthrow them. I love those kind of stories. I definitely prefer complicated villains. I actually also prefer complicated heroes. And this is, I mean, Cassius Vail definitely qualifies. In terms of sociopath, maybe that was a little strong, because I know I don't have a psychology background, but I just got the impression that in terms of a conscience, he really doesn't seem to have much of one, although there are some people that are important to him. Adam, his creation, his son. He does seem to have a soft spot for one of the other main characters, Sage Volus. I like that part about him, and I do like that this is not supposed to be a happy point in human history. You know, we're kind of not really in a good spot. And his creation is Adam, ADIM, and he's an AI robot, and he kind of is his enforcer, but he's not. He seems to be a strong AI, in that he has some. And he's a point of view character, so he has a consciousness, and you get to see part of the story through his, ocular devices, eyes.
Yeah.
I got the impression that like people in the circuit would be repulsed by him, like because he's a, is it because he's a strong AI, and there's kind of like this, repulsiveness at a computer that's resembles human, or is that how it is?
I think it's more just that people have never seen anything like him before, you know, and in the book, he's really as strong of an AI as he is. I tried to write him. He's almost a child. So he has to learn like how we would learn from just being born. So while he learns faster than us, he's still like really understanding his place in the world aside from just serving Cassius. And that's sort of where his development comes, which he wants to and has to serve Cassius, but he sort of starts to figure out better ways that he could do it, which even might push what even Cassius thought he could do or he could want. So I think it's less that people think he's crazy. It's just the Tribune hates all robotics, so they see him as the same as any other robot, whereas the Ceresians, who have robots of their own, would just be amazed that he could think and do things on his own. He's really his own singular being in the book, because there's nothing else like him.
Yeah, the thing I liked about, I mean, he is, in a lot of ways, he reminded me of a little bit of some of the other strong AI characters in science fiction, in that he does have some childlike qualities, but he also has a lot of power. He's a weapon in a lot of ways, and he knows how to move and operate in a very, nasty way. And he is trying to please, Cassius. And so he's not really that kind of, that's another thing. Cause I mean, I guess one could say like in a story like this, maybe the AI, who begins to act like his new surrogate son kind of questions his moral choices. But Adam doesn't really question his moral choices. Adam just kind of questions his tactics. And
yes.
So, and you see kind of the ugly, kind of the ruthlessness of Cassius actually is imprinting on Adam, and Adam is starting to say and do things that are a little unnerving. And it's a cool thing.
Which will hopefully, all that comes to a point in the third book where you'll sort of see him reach the top of his potential, which no one could have predicted, especially Cassius.
Yeah, that's kind of the... So it's always a problem with children in terms of parents. They never seem to come out the way the parents want them to.
Yeah, well, I didn't want an AI like in so many other science fiction where it's not really about becoming self-aware and realizing, oh, humanity has these problems, let me control them and stuff. His singular goal is to please his father. And he can push that and his ability to do that as far as he can go.
He says, I won't spoil it, but he does have a couple creepy lines that when he says it, you just kind of like, okay, Cassius might have just created a monster. But the other, So the third character, I mentioned it earlier, is Sage Volus, who is an executor, who is a true believer in the Tribune and the New Earth, and she had that implant in the first novel. In the second novel, she has it removed, and I think we talked about this in the first episode, that one of the things that kind of comes across in this first novel is that the only female character is basically a helpless servant and doesn't really have any agency in the first novel. But in this one, it's almost like a physical act. The implant is removed, and all of a sudden, that all seems to fade away, and she does become a stronger character. I guess I'm trying to figure out if there's a question in there somewhere. But did you think do you kind of see her as the actual hero and the protagonist in this story, like if there was one, or is she kind of in a way on par, because she has done some terrible things. But I mean, do you kind of, because to me, I kind of feel like there's almost like a rising hero here, you know, executor rising. And there's some qualities about her. I'm like, well, she could become one, but, it's maybe later on. But do you see her as a hero in a way, or is she one of the other great characters?
I think it's hard to pin down a protagonist in this story, especially. I mean, that was how I intended to write it. It probably does shift who's the protagonist throughout. But as far as who has the clearest and most drastic arc as a character, from what she starts as to what she ends as, I would say that's probably her. While Cassius is definitely the most active protagonist, I mean, he is causing everything that's happening, whether intentionally or unintentionally. But you really aren't getting a sense that he's changing as a character from book one through book three. He's not changing. You're just seeing more of what he really is. Whereas Sage is going from sort of this warrior slave to being whatever she wants to be. So there's definitely a clearer arc for her than with any of the characters, her and Adam even.
And it's gradual too, that the implant is removed, and it's not like there's this just flow of, oh my God, what have I been doing this whole time? There is still a very big part of her, and I think this was realistic, and I kind of like that this is where this went, that she didn't just miraculously, abandon her faith and abandon everything she has served when the implant was removed. She still has an internal struggle going on, and I definitely like that part. I also like the fact that, I mean, she was the badass in the first novel, and yet she was helpless, not in control. So, the implant is removed, and you now have the potential here. First, you have doubt, you have the implant removed, and you have the potential for Sage Volus to finally be the badass that I think a lot of readers wanted in the first novel. I know I did. And I think, you get to see a lot of things in this novel. I mean, that's just the one thing I wanted to say is that this book flows just, really well. Like, there's not an easy place to stop. And so a lot of these things happen. And while the character arc, I think you're right. Like, that's the impression I got, is that Sage has the dramatic character arc. Cassius, you're just getting kind of bigger doses of who he really is, not really a change.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's definitely the cool thing. And I definitely, like, when the book was over, I'm like, all right, I want to know I want to see what happens to Sage next, because of the fourth character is Talon Rain. I'm sorry to say, I just think that's a ridiculous name, but whatever. That's just me. But he's kind of like this, this former clan enforcer turned good guy. And he had a little bit of like the anti-hero attitude, that he's done some bad things and he's not a perfect person, but he just seems like an all around good guy. And he's also kind of a love interest to Sage, although that got complicated at the end of the first book. Were you kind of intending to kind of base him on a more like a regular, or not regular, because they're not regular, but like an anti-hero, somebody who, has made mistakes in the past, but is, kind of like that breath of fresh air, like, trust, no guys, I've done this before, we shouldn't do this.
Yeah, that's his archetype, sort of the roguish mercenary type. But like I said, almost every character in this book would be an anti-hero if they were the star of their own book, except for maybe his daughter. But yeah, his archetype, it's sort of taken from the roguish mercenary, but then to add some excitement to it is giving him the sickness, which is really his whole story is driven by that.
Yeah, so that's a sickness you get from exposure to gravitum, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and it's irreversible, it's fatal, and he has it, and a lot of people have it out there. And so he's kind of, so his motivation in the first book was kind of like, I need to get affairs in order so that my daughter's okay when I die. But in the second book, you kind of, it's more towards revenge. And it's kind of, I mean, there's like several, I mean, there's like two or three characters on a revenge bit, but their revenge is like focused on different targets. That's another cool thing, because it's, that is like Game of Thrones too. Like, you have a lot of angry people in Game of Thrones that are trying to get revenge on someone who just killed someone in their family. And it's like this, you know, like this three-way battle going on. And I just thought that was interesting. Did you, what about trying to go through some secondary characters? He has this buddy Tarsus. Can you explain Tarsus a little bit? Because I actually had a little bit of a hard time trying to figure him out.
So Tarsus was a virgin, like the other characters you meet. And before you ever see him in the book itself, he got the Blue Death and was placed. There's a group called the Keepers. Those are the people that run the Solar Arcs.
Right, yeah.
So he got placed on a ship, and he's been one of those for years. So he sort of was one of the head people on the ship. And in the end of the, and in the first book, Talon and him are brought together. So basically, he's just this guy who's accepted that he's going to die, and he doesn't really want for anything until Talon comes into his life and mm-hmm. sort of gives him no choice but to help him. So he's a character who's realizing that maybe in his last days, instead of just living out the rest of his life and doing nothing, he can help someone get what they really want and help a friend who him and Talon sort of has this fast growing friendship. And he could help him save a daughter and do something good with his life instead of just wasting away.
Now and because of the disease, he's kind of like in a cybernetic suit.
Yeah, so he's had the Blue Death for a lot longer than Talon. And the people that have had it for as long as him on the Solar Arcs with the Keepers are given these suits, which help them even move because his muscles alone are too weak. Because that's what the disease degrades your muscles.
Okay. Alrighty, because yeah, I was trying to. I guess I was a little off because I was trying to figure out, like, wait, is he in a suit or is he bionic? Kind of in the way that Sage has that bionic arm.
It's like an exoskeletal suit.
So okay,
it attaches to his limbs.
And then there's also Lenara, the captain of one of the
Lerata, yeah,
the captain of one of the Virgin ships, who I think was kind of, you know, secondary role, but I thought it was an interesting kind of throw in. That the captain is kind of like this older, grizzled woman who's a captain of a ship, and among her crew are, you know, younger guys who you figure wouldn't listen to a woman. But I thought that was pretty cool. And also the young kid's name, the scraggly looking one, I can't think of his name, but
Kit.
Kit, yeah. I mean all these like little characters. I mean, I just all these secondary characters as I was going, like they. They felt a little bit more vivid to me, and I kind of liked it. And every time like a scene was over and I got to the end of the book, I was like, man, I hope like one or more, if not all of these characters have something in the next one, because I was like kind of interested to see where that dynamic went.
Yeah, they all have probably not as satisfying as endings as the four main characters, because as you know, it's pretty focused on them. It's really their story. But they all will have parts to play going into the third one. All pretty important parts as far as they'll continue doing what they were doing in the second one. And I mean, the second book introduces mostly all of the secondary characters, and the third book's just going to take all of those and bring them towards the conclusion of this story. But the second book, I think, where the first book kind of really only focused on the four and the leaders of the Tribune, this is where all the players come in the second book.
The in terms of like just like the impression they leave, I mean, they just leave, I guess, maybe, yeah, because a lot of these secondary characters are introduced in the second book. And I mean, I've already mentioned this a few times, like it just reading this one, just the feel of it was different. Was there like a, when you were writing it or getting it, was there like a pro, like process-wise, did you do something differently with this second book? Because it feels like you did, but I mean, I don't know. Like, was there something different?
No, I think it benefits from the sort of Empire Strikes Back issue, this is probably the probably one of the darker installments compared to the first one. And everything has been set up already, so you're just now seeing these characters in their element. And this one sort of shakes up their lives by throwing them all apart, and you see how they come together again. But the first circuit, it was my first science fiction book. So I think I probably improved as I went, hopefully, as a writer. And I think that's really a big part of what you're seeing.
Yeah, I think it might be that. I don't know what it is, but I think that has something to do with it, that this was the second one. Also, I know you've been writing a number of other things and doing a lot of other writing as well. And I think also you're right. There's not really a lot of exposition in this novel. A lot of the exposition has already been done. So yeah, this is more of an organic story.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of momentum. It doesn't really stop. It's just really four people three out of the four people just trying to survive in the worst situations, just one scene after another, not really a lot of downtime.
Yeah, exactly. They're constantly on the treadmill on this one. There's really not much reprieve. There's a couple reprieves here and there. I mean, just the right amount. This isn't going to wear you out, but the writing process wasn't that different, the things like that. And you said there's going to be three books, so this is going to be a trilogy. I know you told me once that this was actually one big story, and you've worked on breaking it into three novels. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I originally wanted to write it as one big story, but as a new author, it's not really realistic to find a publisher doing that.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, so I wound up breaking it up, but that was when I was writing the first one into the second one. So it wasn't like I finished one big one and then chopped it up.
Yeah.
So it was planned earlier on, and then I had wanted to make it two books, but it really needed to be three. Three books of relatively equal length to break it up evenly. I think if the second one was just one long one, it would have really felt strange being so much longer than the first book. So having three really works, and I think they each have their own vibe. You have the first one, which is really exposition and seeing, it's everything building up to that one moment where you see what Cassius is really up to. The second one is really all of them searching for revenge, and then by the third one, they sort of all have to refigure out what they want.
It follows maybe a little bit of like the classical three act play or the trilogy and which is there. I mean, there's a reason everyone does trilogies. It's the most natural storytelling format you can do. It's a lucky number to a lot of people, but I mean, when I'm writing, I mean, I get the same impression. I also end up just naturally dividing up stories by threes, and that's just the way it is.
I totally agree. It just winds up happening every time.
Yeah. Well, all right. I don't want to give the impression that this is like a social commentary or social science fiction. I don't get that vibe from this novel, but I'm into that. So I couldn't help but notice some of those details. And one of the biggest things I noticed, and I mean, it's not uncommon. A lot of people kind of see when they write, when we start doing future, far future science fiction, a lot of people use kind of like this regression or this kind of descent into a new dark age. And I kind of got the impression from this novel, because you have like a medieval religious fervor surrounding this new earth and this new tribune theocratic power, which, when you imagine something like that taking hold today, it's kind of hard to imagine. But, when things go bad, these kind of things emerge. There's also the clans. The clan is like an old hereditary, familial tribal thing. And there's kind of like this abandonment of enlightenment ideas. Like there's hereditary titles. There's kind of like no concept of liberty or freedom. And I mean, this book happens far after the catastrophe. So it's not post-apocalyptic, but I mean, do you kind of see this as, like, when you're writing this and, like, this is the future, but this is also kind of a new dark age? Like, did you, were you kind of going for that, or was that maybe just by incidental?
I think second dark age is a good way to put what I was going for. I mean, the idea was that when everything in the entire world fell apart, who would take control and who would become the leaders and stuff? And it really, that's how everything comes. I mean, it's a, sort of a wild west of a place. It's just whoever is the strongest or can gather the most followers are the people that come together. So because the Tribune offers this promise of a world again, grass and air and things that humans naturally probably desire, they are able to build the largest following.
And he used a kind of some recognizable social systems here, a religious theocracy, hereditary system, and also kind of an organized crime system. And also the Gravitum disaster that kills Earth is kind of I kind of took it as it's another way that we all kind of feel like at some point we're very close to killing this freaking planet, and we're all going to pay the price. And what follows will inevitably be a descent of civilization. I mean, do you like personally feel like these things are very likely, or is this just you? Like, no, this is fiction.
I don't know if anything that drastic, but I mean, it was the idea if we did discover an element like that with that kind of power and that kind of ability, of course, everyone would overmine it and abuse it. And that is what pushed the Earth to the brink and what caused it to ruin. Whether, I mean, obviously this is a made up element and that's not a realistic fate. But the idea that if we discovered something like that, would we push it too far?
Uh-oh.
I don't know what that was. If we discovered something, would we push it too far? And I figured, yeah, I mean, that's the whole crux of what happens to humanity in the story.
And you kind of see like a little bit, I mean, we have like, historical examples of this, like the tribes on Easter Island and things like that. It was, and also, I mean, you use a fictional element kind of similar to, you know, in Avatar, they have unobtainium, which I'm just glad you didn't use a name that was ridiculous like that. unobtainium. Like,
yeah,
what?
I hated that.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I know it's a blockbuster kind of popcorn movie, but come on, James Cameron, that was just insulting. But anyway, I don't know. Was there anything else I kind of I'm missing here? Was like another part of the story here that because I know we covered all the characters, covered the world building, but I mean these were just the things that kind of really struck out to me about this book when I finished it. So is there, or can you give us maybe a little bit of a teaser of where this is going?
Yeah. Well, that's obviously we're trying to have a conversation without any spoilers in it. So
yes, yes,
which sure. Is always kind of tough. But I think, I mean, the third book, it's a conclusion. Mm-hmm. I can't be any more specific than that. But you're going to get a pretty concluding moment in these stories, at least the arcs that are being told in this story itself for each character. No one's going to have a thread left open. And so hopefully it's satisfying, but I think you're going to see some surprises and a lot of things that probably you could predict that have been building up for two books that are going to come to fruition in even more horrible ways than you can imagine, as as this book tends to do.
Excellent. So the third one is written. Do you have any kind of idea on timeline of when it'll be coming out?
Recently, I actually found out. So the third one is in copy editing right now. The publisher wants to release it in December of this year, potentially earlier. So a lot sooner than the second one came after the first one. So okay. it would wind up being 9 months, but that's the plan. So I should have arcs ready soon, and it's called The Circuit Earthfall.
Earthfall, okay. All right, so this is about, I don't know, like 9 months since the last time we talked. Is there anything like when you write now, like something you've learned like between books one and two, or maybe after book two, like about writing or about your process that maybe you didn't know before?
I self-editing, I think, is one of the most important things any writer can learn how to do. And really, I've learned a lot about that since I've been doing some freelance editing, and I've now worked with different editors, good and bad, and the different publishers I work with. And it's really learning a lot about flow and just maintaining conflicts in everything that's happening with your characters. Even if it's not a violent conflict or anything. I mean, The Circuit is a very, very violent space opera. But even just conflict in a conversation at any time, just adding tension to characters is really what makes a good story, I think. And I mean, I've been doing some editing and reading some stories, and I think some earlier writers I'm reading, you get a couple chapters in, and while the writing is good and everything, you're wondering what is the major conflict. And I think that's something every story should try to establish early, is really a major conflict, even if it's going to shift. And that's something I'm always focusing on creating. I mean, a lot of my work now, I'm trying out this thing. I mean, most of my novels, it's really futures where Earth has fallen apart, but different outcomes and different reasons and what comes about from it. So that's my other novel, Titanborn, has a similar world where Earth has fallen, but at completely different reasons, and it's led to a completely different civilization. And I mean, those are just really settings. So I'm trying to create more personalized stories, more character-driven stories in these settings. So it really becomes less about those and more about the characters. But you always need an interesting one in science fiction, and drama and destruction like that is a good background to build tension for your characters.
So do you find like you're spending more time or maybe more words describing people than things?
No, I think I'm spending less words describing anything overall. And that's something, trimming is something I've learned a lot from my editors.
Right, right. Like getting rid of info dumping and things like that, kind of basic. It's
even less of, because I mean, in science fiction, fantasy, info dumping, a lot of times it's necessary. Sometimes you really need it to describe certain areas.
Oh, yeah. What I mean is, there's exposition that's necessary. I guess when editors have told me this is info dump or someone, usually it's information that is not necessary and slash. But no, I get what you mean. We're in speculative fiction. You need to, exposition is necessary because it doesn't take place in a familiar world. But when I've read, I've read a lot of self-published or indie published novels, and there's just some points where they're explaining things, and you just, by the end of it, you're like, wait, that never really came into play.
Yeah, like, you definitely have to be careful with it and try to keep it as short as possible. But I think the main thing in overwriting that I found, even through editing, is a lot of times is describing things that aren't info dumping, but that are described right in the dialogue above it, or described through subtext that you really didn't need it to be stated outright.
Yeah.
And then just trimming little things like that could really help with the flow of a novel and keeping the dialogue crisp and moving, instead of saying too much what the characters are doing themselves and almost making it like a screenplay. So I think that's where a lot of my focus goes on now as far as the writing itself. But for books, I mean, somehow, no matter what subgenre of science fiction I pick, I'm always writing books that are more character studies than anything. I mean, even The Circuit is like that. It's very character driven and about just these people push to the limits what they do. And so that's always my focus, to try to keep interesting characters put into interesting situations and really focus on them at a personal level rather than the war. I mean, The Circuit 2 is about a war, and that you're hardly involved in that war. You're just seeing it through the eyes of these main characters.
No, I definitely got that impression from this. I mean, the first novel, I don't think suffered from those kind of stylistic issues, unlike some of the other things I've read of late. The thing I was thinking of is, I mean, is there anything like outside of science fiction and fantasy that you use, maybe like for some people I know that sometimes they kind of draw some inspiration from mythology or from some of their favorite, you know, dramas or action movies that are not necessarily science fiction. Do you like as you're going along and kind of doing more of this character driven stuff and doing more with people rather than things, is there anything outside of science fiction you kind of draw on to build on that, or is this a lot of it kind of personal experience?
I would say a lot with TV and movies, probably. I mean, I mostly only read science fiction and fantasy because I enjoy it. And also I see it sort of as an education process, reading other people's work.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But I mean, if you just pay attention to the dialogue and character arcs on a really well written show, like Better Call Saul right now, I don't think there's anything like it on TV. I think you could learn a lot about building an interesting character and keeping dialogue fresh and meaningful from watching shows like that and movies well written like that as well.
Yeah, I think for me, I've only seen a little bit of Breaking Bad, but it's amazing.
Yeah, I've watched
Better Call Saul as well. Game of Thrones, of course, is incredible in terms of writing, and as dull as some of the episodes are, and I guess for me, and I agree with you entirely. I'm a child of the '90s, so most of my exposure to entertainment and culture and media was television and movies, and so mine is a lot of movies, whether they're science fiction or otherwise. But more recently, it's been kind of these dramas, like the one, you know, Better Call Saul, but also, I mean, The Walking Dead to me is phenomenal in a lot of ways, that it can carry a cast of 8 to 12, you know, major characters and not bore you to death. And that's really, it's an impressive, and Game of Thrones, of course, which has about 167 characters. So, I mean, those things are impressive and they're really just getting people gripped. I know one of the new ones that's more closer to what you and I do and what we talk about is The Expanse. Did you get a chance to watch the first season?
Yeah, I thought it was, as far as production value on a science fiction show, I haven't seen anything like that in a while.
Yes, definitely.
I thought they moved a little bit too slow compared to the book, which I liked the show better than the book, actually. I read the first book, but I think they drew it out a little bit too much and could have been a little clearer on things. But I mean, overall, I thought for a science fiction show, it was pretty awesome.
It was. The book is actually, in my opinion, I mean, just my impression, the book Leviathan Wakes is really not that great, but that show is really good. And
well, they kind of, I mean, in the book, none of the characters are complex and none of the secondary characters really do anything different. They're all like the same.
Yeah, exactly.
But in the show, they really gave each one of them their own personality and their own purposes, and sort of added tension between them. That there was no tension between Amos and Holden in the book at all. And in the show, that is like a major part of the first half. So I think adding little things like that to make the other characters more than just characters running around with the main guys, I think that was what made the show so much better for me.
Yeah, in the book, and a lot of sci-fi novels have this, it's almost like, I actually learned it, there's a term, it's called the Marty Stew character, the Mary Sue character, is basically a character that has unrealistic abilities and is just perfect in every way. And the story is just about, you know, them proving their awesomeness and everyone else kind of realizing it and adoring them. And I think Leviathan Wakes, I guess, was a little bit guilty of it with Holden.
Yeah, I could see that, because he did have this whole crew who just automatically accepted him, and he was always this righteous character. But in the show, they really showed like how his self-righteousness gets them into a lot of problems.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he is definitely, and Miller as well. Like both characters, but Holden in particular in the book, are more, you know, they seem to be too good to be true, and things just kind of fall into their laps. But in the show, that is not the case at all, and I like that a lot. I also like the way they portrayed the ringers or belters, the height and the language alterate, which I don't remember from the book. I thought that was really interesting.
I remember that. That was a little bit in the book. I mean, they mentioned the language, and then they talked about the height, but I don't remember. I mean, the show added how they needed to have the surgery on their spine sometimes just to survive, and really built that language into a real sounding language and everything. I thought they developed it far, and sometimes a little too far that you couldn't really even understand them at all.
Yeah, the sound in the first two episodes, and I think the first episode is like a two-hour block, the way they released it.
Yeah,
the sound was not that good. It's hard, even with the volume at full blast, it's hard to understand. And the way Miller talks is, you know, that low, you know, hey, you know what?
Yeah, it was, you know? It was hard. Without reading, having read the book and knowing, like, who was against who and who hated who, I think it would have been pretty tough to follow those first few episodes. That was the one benefit I found from reading the book. But I really think the show is an example of how you could take the exact same storyline and just little changes with the characters can make it so much stronger, which is adding that tension and that three-dimensionality to the people that are with them instead of them just being with them.
Yeah, that's exactly. With the crew in particular, Holden's crew, I mean, there is tension, you know, either one direction, two direction, you know, whether it's Naomi or Holden or Amos or whatever. There's a lot more of it in the show than there was in the book, and all these different opportunities to, you know, exhibit these pressures on these people, as well as, you know, the broader war. I think, like, a lot of, and I think I was, you know, a lot of writers, I think, are guilty of this. I was, that you kind of feel like the broader conflict is tension enough. And at the broader war or whatever is tension enough, you know, good. But that's really not true. And I guess, and especially if you watch a lot of, or you get to read a lot of military fiction or watch a lot of military documentaries, you realize that when soldiers are in battle or when people are in these intense situations, they don't think in terms of the geopolitical, you know, realities of it or whatever.
And, yeah, they're just out for each other and themselves.
Yeah, I mean, they're not flag waving, you know, patriots, you know, 24/7 while they're on the front. You know, a lot of times they're pretty angry at their own country at some of the things they have to do. And anyway, that's the expand. I'm looking forward to the next season. What are you working on right now?
Right now, me and my publisher. I know you've read Titanborn, I believe, and
yes.
I know about it, and that's coming out in June. So there's a sequel to that written, which right now we're working on editing and seeing if they want to publish that. That's finished. So right now, as far as writing, I'm working on a third Titanborn, which each Titanborn is a standalone story in the same universe. So I'm working on a third book in that universe, and also another book that I haven't shown anyone yet.
Do you feel like you want to keep doing like trilogies or series, or do you, cause I've been getting the itch to do standalones.
That was the whole reason I went with Titanborn. Cause I mean, the circuit was this long continuous story. I mean, you can't read the second one without the first one. It really wouldn't make sense. It's just a long building story. So I'm Titanborn where maybe it might be a trilogy or have four books or a series. I always wanted each book to stand together. I mean, the second Titanborn features an entirely new narrator and main character. And then the other book I'm working on right now, which is called Vicarious, is its own standalone as well. So I'm definitely focusing more on standalone just because I know I prefer myself to read a standalone book than get involved in a huge, long trilogy. That's a lot of them are often drawn out.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to do. And I mean, like, everyone will see, and potentially people will be disappointed and when the sequel comes out of Titanborn and it's not an exact sequel to the first book. It's more of a companion book taking place in the same universe, but it's its own story. And that's more of the direction I want to take it, that even if books are connected in their universe, each one can stand alone on its own merit and be its own story.
Yeah, I guess. Well, I mean, it's up to the publisher, but I mean, my suggestion would have been, or is, that when you do that, the titles should not follow convention. Like, for example, Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake, Mad Adam, Year of the Flood, all three of them take place in the same universe, but they're different sets of characters. But all three titles are unique. You can't really connect them. The only way you would know that they're part of the same part of the same universe is, you know, maybe you read it somewhere in the summary, or if you look on Goodreads or whatever, you see in parentheses Mad Adam number one or two or three. I mean, I would, that, I, you know, it's up to them. They make the calls, of course, but just in my own work, I've been naming things, you know, if I want things to be standalone, I've been thinking, well, give them all their own unique name and don't call it, you know, this part one, this, obviously this part one, this part two is not going to do it. But like, you know, just unique titles, I guess. But I know, but I'm just, in science fiction, we're obsessed with series. I mean, that's just how we are. Fortunately.
Yeah, well, we want to see worlds develop and characters develop in epic ways. And yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think right now our plan is not to call it like Titanborn 2 this.
Yeah.
I think it's going to have its own title. And maybe it'll say a Titanborn novel or something like that. But yeah, I don't think it'll be marketed as a direct sequel, because it's a good way to get someone to just come on and one star you and say, this isn't the same character. This book sucks. I can't make it past page two.
Yeah, another author did that with their series. It was a unique name to each book, but it was clearly labeled number one, number two, number three. And I read number two and I'm like, it's a good book, but this is an entirely new set of characters and a completely different planet. What the hell? You know, I was a little irritated and so I get it. Yeah, I get you. Let's see, between last time and this time we talked, obviously The Force Awakens happened. We already went back and forth on this a few times already, but I guess maybe for the purposes of this show, I mean, what did you think of The Force Awakens, and did it satisfy?
Did it satisfy? I mean, it definitely satisfied. As a Star Wars movie, you'd have to be crazy to go in and say you hated it. If you liked any of the other Star Wars, it was a great movie. I mean, the one disappointment was how much it clung to Episode 4 and the same sort of storyline beats.
Yes, absolutely.
It definitely hits each of the same beats, even if it hits them in different ways. But I think the thing that people are latching onto the most to this one, which is great, is all the new characters were excellent. It was great characters, great acting, great dialogue, which I can't say has been in any Star Wars movie ever. Even in the originals, some of the lines are bad, or I mean, in Episode 4, Luke was kind of naggy. I mean, every single new character really brought a lot. I thought they were great. I know a lot of people have mixed feelings on Kylo Ren. I thought having a complex villain that wasn't a perfected villain was actually even more interesting than having Vader, who was, I mean, he was Vader and he was always Vader. He was just a badass, whereas Kylo Ren was not a badass yet. He was just trying to be. I thought that was an interesting take on a villain.
I agree almost across the board. My biggest the thing that it kind of slowed me down was definitely the almost point to point matching of Episode 4. I mean at bare minimum it would have been nice if Jakku was a jungle planet instead of another desert planet. I mean, something as simple as that might have helped. The missing droid, I mean the giant planet destroying weapon and things like that. I believe they can get away with that for one movie. They definitely cannot get away with cloning Empire in Episode 8. I don't think they're going to try, but I think you're right. I think this is the only movie where I think you could have gotten away with matching a previous movie.
I think they needed to kick off Star Wars again, almost serving as like a reboot. But I think they did a great job introducing new characters with interesting dynamics that hopefully in the next one they could take in a different direction than Empire, even if it's going to be the dark second movie in a trilogy, which that is always the case. Yeah. Hopefully they're going to take these characters in a different direction, which it seems like they're planning to. And I think that's great, because I mean, in between Episode 4 and 5, Vader didn't change. Between this episode and the next one, Kylo Ren has to change. Based on losing and how much that's going to affect him.
Yeah, and the thing with Kylo Ren is, and I know that you're right, that this is the first time we've had a villain that is unfinished, an unfinished product, which makes sense because the Sith are supposed to be extinct. So how could a finished product be out there unless the Sith are still alive? There is Snoke, and there possibly is another emergency. I've heard some great, really entertaining theories on who Snoke is and who Rey is. I mean, I don't really want to go into them again, but basically everyone's wondering who these characters are and where it's going. And of course the emo Kylo Ren Twitter feed, which is hysterical.
Which is
pretty
funny.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And I mean, and also the skit they did on SNL where he is the undercover boss on the Starkiller base, and everyone can figure out right away. It's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure Steve is Kylo Ren, like 90% sure. And he's just this nerdy little tech. I mean, it's funny stuff. And I think, I had a lot of fun watching the movie. I think it was entertaining. It was a lot of fun. Johnny Boyega as Finn and Oscar Isaac, the kind of bromance those things pat around have. I mean, this is all great stuff. And just watching it unfold again and doing it properly with some pretty good dialogue. I think you're right. It might have been the best dialogue of all the movies, because the dialogue in the prequels is pretty bad, and four is pretty cheesy by modern standards. And absolutely, I mean, that's,
yeah, I think they were just the most captivating group of characters. Even Harrison Ford was great in it, but I think there was just a lot of chemistry between every character that I don't think there ever was in any other of the Star Wars. And I mean Daisy Ridley was amazing too, and yes. I know there's a lot of people which I think is just people don't like having a female main character, who say she was that Mary Sue character we talked about earlier, which
partially,
I mean, it's so obvious in the movie that she's either related to the Skywalkers or Obi-Wan. So you know she has that strong connection to the Force, which was the same thing Luke and Anakin had, which is why they were also good at everything. It's the same themes of story. So I don't think she's any more of a Mary Sue than any Jedi is. I mean, that's what they are. They're good at things.
Now, yeah, that's why I read that a few places, and I it's hard for me to say that she's not. I don't think she's a Mary Sue, because of all of her abilities are pretty clearly explained. So, and they're also not, like you said, they're not unrealistic. This is what Jedi are. So
yeah, and there's also
it doesn't come out of the ether that she's good at these.
No, and I'm not getting the sense that she's just learned through these things. There's so many hints that her mind was wiped and that she's had some training, and it's called The Force Awakens. It was clearly about her.
Yeah, and I'm pretty
and it was her that moment where she's being tortured and she figures out she can control someone's mind. I think it was just a lot of her mind sort of opening to things that already knew that have been taken from her. And they're definitely going to explain it in the next one, that who she's related to, which is why she's so strong in the Force. But to call her character Mary Sue and that be a complaint, but be totally fine with Luke or Anakin or Obi-Wan or anything and anything these characters who are magical warriors can do is pretty silly.
It is. I've had like eight different conversations on this with a bunch of people. I do believe that Rey is an ex-Padawan of Luke's, and that's why she's not just, it's not that she's force sensitive and all of a sudden these abilities are coming to her. I agree with you. I believe she's had some training, and that's why she can do these things. And secondly, I understand the easiest way is to put her somewhere in the family tree. I think that they're very likely to do that, but I just think it would be very cool if in this saga she is not related to anyone. She was just the ace pupil of Luke, and Kylo Ren, aka Ben Solo, was so thinking that he deserved that mantle because he was the heir. He's supposed to be the top one, but he's not, and that's when he had his freak out and, you know, probably murdered all the Padawans and whatever. Yeah. That's my alternate theory. But I think it could go either way, and it's going to be a lot of fun either way.
I think there's a reason they introduced into the movies the idea that the Force can be used to wipe minds and read minds.
Yes.
I don't think that was an accident. And it seems to me, based on her being brought when she was a kid, that they kind of took those memories from her, and all she remembers is being left behind and waiting.
Yeah.
Whether she's related to Luke, which I think they're going to do that. I think it'd be cooler if somehow she was a Kenobi.
Like
they've always said, the main episodes have always been a story about the Skywalkers.
I do think, but I think maybe it was you and I that said this, that really the Skywalker angle is going to be Kylo Ren. And, yeah. And it's not going to be Rey. Rey is going to be the outsider. Well, Rey could also be, you know, a Kenobi. But, like, the continuation of the Skywalker saga is going to flow through Kylo Ren, and you might see a reverse arc of somebody who is evil and takes the path to good. And you already see that. Kylo Ren, at certain points, is struggling with... it's weird to see an evil person struggle with being good, because that's, you know, the rest of us experience it the other way. Yeah, but you get that.
Usual path.
No, usually the good is not tempting you. Usually it's evil that's tempting you. So I hope they kind of work on that a little bit more in the next movie. But I'm with you. I was very impressed with this movie. They did it right. This is a Star Wars movie. This is exactly what you had to do.
It was the main thing I think that they needed. And it was a good reason to bring in J.J. Abrams to inject it with that sort of energy.
And a lot of the writers from the first, from 4, yeah. 5, and 6 were involved. And of course, you bring in some of the legacy characters. And I'm pretty disappointed in Carrie Fisher. But Harrison Ford did a phenomenal job. And I'm pretty sure Mark Hamill can hold his own. Mark Hamill's been doing a lot of things since then that are kind of more comedy. And so he's been active, and I actually think he'll do a pretty good job. Carrie Fisher was just a plastic face.
That was the main problem. And I don't think they're going to give her much bigger of a part than she had in this one, which is good.
Yeah. Yeah, she just can't do it. I mean, I don't.
She served her role well enough, but yeah, she just couldn't do it. I mean, I'm pretty sure that the only reason that she was never... that in the movie they say that she never gets training to be a Jedi herself is because I don't think Carrie Fisher could handle doing that much anymore.
No, and yeah, and it wasn't really a great role to have, you know, the ex-lovers, the ex-family, but her just, her plastic face and just her inability to really emote much, and she's kind of just watching all these things unfold without much to say or do. And it just didn't work. But I think just in general, I don't know there's really much role she can play as we go forward, because it's like, she's the mother. So is the mother going to engage it, you know, go head to head with the son? Of course not. You know, it's probably going to be the uncle. It's going to be Uncle Luke or Rey. So
yeah. Or Rey, who's probably going to wind up being his cousin.
Something like that. And also the droid BB-8 was awesome.
Yes, I mean, if on the Blu-ray they have a whole making of thing for him, and they did
a good job.
He was such a cool little character.
All right. Well, all right. I think I'm about at the hour mark, so I should leave it there. The book is The Circuit: Progeny of Vale, number 2 in the Circuit series by Rhett C. Bruno. I highly recommend it. It is one of the best space operas out there. This is a subgenre that has a lot of Me Toos and a lot of copies and a lot of things that are based on something else. This one is pretty unique. I can't really think of a good analog, which for me is a good thing. I always like books that kind of try to deviate from whatever, you know, whatever's in the zeitgeist or whatever. So, Rhett, thanks for joining me. And
thanks for having me, and thanks for the compliment. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was excellent book. I enjoyed it a lot. All right, well, we'll leave it there, and until next time.
All right, thank you.
All right, that was our interview with author Rhett C. Bruno. If you are a self-published author or one with a book through a small press and would like a review and possibly an interview here on Thought Crime, email me at jwfox@prescientscifi.com. That is scifi.com. Please, science fiction only. That is my exclusive focus. Anything within the science fiction genre, dystopias, post-apocalyptic, even steampunk, space operas, and things like that of nature. So anything under those, send it to me, and I'll see if I choose to read it. And if I like it, we'll do a review and do an interview. You can follow us on Twitter at Prescient Sci-Fi. That's Prescient, S-C-I-F-I. You can also friend us on Facebook. So that'll do it for this episode. Until next time.